That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are times when Asif Manvi's interviews for The Daily Show are just plain cringeworthy. Here he is with Don Yelton, former North Carolina GOP precinct chair and member of that state's Republican Party Executive Committee.
But I think I've treated you the same as I would anybody else.
Right.
Matter of fact, one of my best friends is black.
So one of your best friends?
One of my best friends.
Is black?
Yes.
Yelton also complained that only black people can use the N-word and thought it was just fine if the state's mandatory voter ID law, quote, hurts a bunch of lazy blacks, unquote. He was asked to resign the day after that interview ran. It was never Manvi's goal to be a muckraking gotcha journalist. Funny fake reporter is just one of many roles that he's taken on as an actor. But then Manvi has had a number of identities thrust on him since he moved from India to England and then to Florida as a high school junior. He writes about many of them in a new collection of essays called No Land's Man. And Asif Manvi, actor, writer, and The Daily Show's senior Muslim correspondent, senior brown correspondent, senior foreign-looking correspondent. Have I missed any?
I think maybe a senior doctor correspondent.
I think that's that sounds really professional. What could you possibly have been thinking when Don Yelton was talking, you know, about Obama as a witch doctor? And I mean, did you think, okay, this is great comedy? This dude's sinking himself without even knowing it? What?
I think in that moment, you know, you really just want to stay out of the way. The impulse is always to try to, you know, drive the bus somewhere, you know, so you have something in the interview. And then something like that happens where he just starts to speak like that. And then, you know, it reminded me something Stephen Colbert said to me when I first started The Daily Show, which is that when you know, put a camera in someone's face, they get a lobotomy. And I thought to myself, oh, this is happening. And it never had the consequence that it had with Don Yelton, but it has happened in many other interviews. So I knew well enough to just stay out of the way and let him keep going. And I knew that we were getting great stuff. And it's, you know, in spite of all the sort of things he was saying, you know, as a Daily Show reporter, your heart just gets filled up with when that kind of thing happens.
Well, I remember you interviewing a woman who said some, you know, crazy things like, oh God, what was it? Something like a third of Muslims are terrorists.
Yeah, one out of every five Muslim is a terrorist or something like that.
Is it ever infuriating? Do you ever think, I just want to strangle this person?
Right. I mean, you know, there was a string of interviews that I did for a while there where I was talking to a lot of like Muslim haters. And that started to get to me a little bit after a while. And I remember talking to John and just saying like, you know, maybe I'll just go out and talk to somebody, you know, just a regular kind of nut job, you know. And that woman actually that I spoke to in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, she was a particular, very specific kind of crazy. Like she actually – I think I said to her in the interview that, you know, I'm Muslim. And she said something innocuous like, oh, I figured you were. And then we were changing tape and her husband off to the side said, hey, honey, you know, next time he tells you that you're Muslim, maybe you can say not everyone's perfect.
Ooh.
And so she asked us to actually go back and ask her the question again because she thought, oh, this will be really funny. And of course, again, it was a moment where I was just like my heart filled, you know, and I thought this is – she has no idea what she's about to do, you know?
Now, this is a job that you almost didn't take. You write in one of the essays, you were in a funk, you were writing a letter to your ex-girlfriend, recently engaged. When you got the call about auditioning for The Daily Show and you said, well, I'm going to give you the polite version. I'm not talking to them right now. Why?
You know, they called and they said the Daily Show is looking for a Middle Eastern looking guy. And I thought, well, this is either the most elaborate Homeland Security sting operation I've ever heard of, or I'm going to end up down at the Daily Show studios, like putting on a fake beard and some sketch and yelling death to America or something like that. So I was like, forget it. I'm not doing that. I'd done these kinds of things before, Letterman and Jimmy Kimmel and, you know. And so I thought, I'm not doing it. And so I said no. And then they called back and they said, oh, actually, it's for a correspondent. And they would like you to come down by 3 o'clock. So I literally got down there at 3 o'clock. And then John hired me right there. And then I was on the show that evening. It was on the air later that night. And then I didn't have time to tell anybody. And then my phone just started ringing at 11:30 that night. You know, people, did I just see someone who looks very much like you on The Daily Show? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, in the book, we learn a lot about your parents. You know, there are a lot of stories about them. And their response to this offer was, is this John Stewart fellow crazy? What?
Yeah. Well, my dad said, you know, is this John Stewart fellow crazy? How can he hire someone who doesn't even know how to say salam alaikum to be his senior bloody Muslim correspondent? And I said, you know, Dad, it's a comedy show. And he said, I hope it's a comedy show. You know, because I was the last person to represent Islam or Muslims in any way. You know, I've been in more bars than mosques in my life. And so it was kind of bananas for me that I would even be representing in this way, you know. But as I was on The Daily Show and as the years went by, I realized, like, oh, I was able to speak into the zeitgeist in some way, and it was really affecting American Muslims, more than it was affecting policy or lawmakers or the media. It was affecting American Muslims, and they were excited about it. And that sort of, in a weird way, sort of made me feel kind of Muslimy, you know, and it was very uncomfortable for a while.
Well, and it is making fun of bigotry in so many cases in such a funny way. But this real name-calling, systemic kind of racism has been a big part of your life. Were you aware of, you know, being a Muslim, being an outsider before your family moved from Bombay to England, where, of course, you know, you were the outsider?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I grew up in the north of England in a city called Bradford, and I grew up there in the 70s. And it was very, you know, there was definitely racism towards people from the subcontinent, Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis. And there was, you know, and it was at the time politically in England at that time also. The National Front was very powerful, which is a very sort of conservative political group, which was wanting to get rid of all the foreigners and everything. And so, like, I grew up around that and in the midst of all of that. The interesting thing is, I talk about this in the book as well, like, that the difference between being an immigrant in England versus being an immigrant in the United States is that in England, I always felt like no matter how long you're there and no matter how many roots you plant there, you'll never be completely accepted as truly British. And in America, the opposite seems to be true, where there's a sort of openness and acceptance of immigrants and all that. But on the flip side of that, there's very little curiosity about other cultures and about other places. And Americans sort of, you know, I say that, you know, Americans think about the rest of the world the way New Yorkers think about the rest of America. They don't. And that was very clear to me when I got to America and realized, like, you know, it was either you were either black, you were white, you were Hispanic, or you were invisible, you know?
We're speaking with Asif Manvi, who is an actor who many people may know as from The Daily Show. His new collection of essays is called No Land's Man. Why did your family actually move to the U.S.?
They moved to the U.S. because, well, my dad, he wanted to, he always wanted to move to Canada, actually, and then he found an old college buddy of his who lived in Tampa, Florida. And he was like, Tampa, it's the great American city. It's the city of the future. Come here. So he went, he came out to America on a reconnaissance mission just to check out Florida. And I guess somebody took him out to eat brunch. And he fell in love with the idea of brunch. And I think he thought it was like a third meal. And I have a whole story about it in the book about how he called us from Florida, and he was like, you know, in America, they have this thing, it's called brunch. They have so much food that between breakfast and lunch, they have to stop and eat again. Breakfast and he thought it was a combination. And he, you know, it was like he got here and it was like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory for my dad, you know. He sort of embraced the consumer culture with an open mouth, you know.
Well, so this was in the 1980s. when The Cosby Show was on the air, and you do your own very funny bit from The Daily Show. It's a kind of riff on an integrated family. This is The Cosby Show. That's Q-U-apostrophe-O-S-B-Y.
Someone made snacks for his hardworking kids.
Oh, thanks, Dad. BLT.
Tommy, I made your favorite, baby back ribs. Tommy.
Yeah, Dad?
How many times have I told you not to listen to your iPod while you're doing your homework?
Your father's right, honey.
Yeah, but come on, it's the new Toby Keith album.
Oh, well, why didn't you tell us? What are you hogging it all to yourself for? Turn it off!
So there you are playing the Cosby Dad. Tell us about that clip.
Well, we created this parody sitcom based on something that Katie Couric said, where she said, you know, maybe what American Muslims need is what African Americans had in the 80s, which was their own version of a Cosby Show. Mm. And maybe that would help with some of the racism and bigotry. And so we took that to its literal extreme, because that's what we do on The Daily Show, and created the Cosby Show, Q-U-apostrophe-O-S-B-Y. And it was the all-American Muslim family that we showed it to a panel of New Yorkers, and they thought it was and we presented it like it was a real show, and we wanted to get their opinions, and we got some very interesting and scary responses. I've actually created a web series based on that episode, on that idea of the Cosby Show. It's going to be coming out later in the end of the year early next year.
What kind of faces were you seeing on television when you were growing up? I mean, obviously not any that looked very much like yours.
No, I mean, I decided I wanted to be an actor when I was very young. And, you know, my impression of sort of I grew up on American pop culture. I grew up on, you know, all the American 70s television shows. And, you know, I used to watch Happy Days, and I used to watch The Fonz. And I remember thinking, you know, that his name was Arthur Fonzarelli, and he was really cool. And so maybe me, with my dorky name, which was Asif Mandviwala, could also be really cool, you know, and I could be the Mons or something. And so I had this image, you know, this kind of image of sort of masculinity, American masculinity, which is sort of, you know, borrowed from James Dean. And then what happens is, you're an immigrant kid, like, you have that. And then on the other side of it, you have your dad, who's like a shopkeeper and doesn't really know how to navigate the culture or the language. And so you're trying to find that image. And then my mother, actually, when I told her I wanted to be an actor, she suggested that I look at Omar Sharif. And she said, you know, you want to be an actor like Omar Sharif. And I didn't know who Omar Sharif was. And then I saw him, and it was the first time that I saw a brown man in a Hollywood movie, not
Zhivago,
playing a servant or Gunga Din or something, you know. And he was this man. He was a gentleman. And it gave me a possibility because he existed.
And also Michael Jackson, I guess you took on that role. It's a very, very funny story about you bringing the house down at a high school variety show, doing your Michael Jackson impersonation. But I thought even funnier was you rehearsing that for your grandparents. Tell us what happened.
Right. That story is it's about Michael Jackson, but it's also about race. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this idea that, like, I decided that I could impersonate Michael Jackson. I realized I could moonwalk and I could sort of sing like him. And I had a jerry curl, and both of us looked like an Indian girl. So, you know, we kind of could match on that level. And so I put together this costume and the thing. And then I, you know, my grandparents were visiting from India. And of course, they had no idea who Michael Jackson is or was. And I'm doing these spins and these things, and I'm falling down. It was very bad. It was not good. And my grandmother, God bless her, she was incredibly supportive. And for months afterwards, she would come into my bedroom and sort of, like, with a cheeky grin on her face, she would always say, "Billy Jesus, not my lawyer." Because that's what she thought the song was.
So many good stories in this book. But, you know, they're so funny, but there's a lot of poignancy here of somebody kind of like viewing the world as, I don't know, the guy who's always had the roles, the names, the epithets kind of thrust upon him. And you even play with that a little bit in your book trailer. You know, you're not quite Muslim enough, you're not quite Indian enough, you're not quite English enough. Is that something you truly struggle with, or does it just make for great comedy?
Well, I think that, you know, look, the title comes exactly from that, the No Land's Man, you know, that sense of belonging nowhere and everywhere. And I think that theme of the outsider, which I think a lot of immigrants can relate to, you know, I had it on different continents. But as an adult, it kind of became my multiplicity has become, I think, in some ways my power, you know, at least that's how I look at it. And, you know, and especially when I got to The Daily Show, you know, the idea that I could inhabit this voice that was both an outsider and an insider at the same time was incredibly powerful. And I realized that, like, that was the uniqueness of my voice in terms of what The Daily Show was able to present. We are who we are, you know, and that was the sort of journey of what happened to me. But I feel like it kind of shaped me into who I am, and also perhaps and not perhaps, it has informed the kind of actor that I am as well, you know.
Well, Asif Manvi, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Asif Manvi, his new collection of essays is called No Land's Man. There's a hilarious book trailer that you can watch, and there's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, what happens when one woman refuses to move in the face of massive commercial development plans? We're going to find out when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When a city or town is growing, commercial development is bound to be a driver. For people who have deep roots in a place, it can be difficult to stand in the way of what many others regard as progress, especially when offered a lot of money to get out of the way. Roman Mars and Katie Mingle of 99% Invisible bring us this story of one legendary development holdout.
There's a neighborhood in Seattle called Ballard. It used to be its own city until it was annexed into Seattle in 1907, so it's always had the feel of a small town. A lot of single-family homes and small businesses. That started to change around 2005 when Ballard started to see unprecedented growth. Tons of new condos and apartment buildings were springing up.
And around this time, a developer decided to build a shopping mall on a more or less vacant block in Ballard.
That's our producer, Katie Mingle.
Vacant except for one steadfast tenant who had been there for the last 50 years. Her name, Edith Macefield.
The developers offered Mrs. Macefield $1 million for her tiny house,
which was appraised at about $120,000. She said no.
The Ballard woman who refused to sell her little house to developers.
The little old lady being bullied by developers.
The story was classic David and Goliath. Edith Macefield versus the big bad developers.
Hi, I'm Barry Martin. I work in construction as a project superintendent.
Barry Martin was hired to oversee the shopping center project, and when he heard about Edith Macefield, he wasn't super excited.
All she has to do is complain, tell somebody at the TV station or on the newspaper, or, you know, it'll be a really big deal.
But even though the press was clamoring to talk to Mrs. Macefield, she wanted nothing to do with talking to them. Here's Mrs. Macefield turning down help from a CBS reporter as she took out some trash in her front yard.
Do you want some help, Edith?
No.
Later in the segment, he knocks on her door, and you can hear a muffled, "Go away."
Is there any...
Go away.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that muffled recording of a cranky Mrs. Macefield is the only one we could find of her.
The construction project got underway.
And all the while, Mrs. Macefield went about her business day after day, just like she'd always done.
She'd get up in the morning and feed the birds and throw bird seed out on the sidewalk. Most of the time, the bird seed would be there when we got to work.
If they didn't see the bird seed, Barry would knock on her door to see if she was okay.
And she would usually yell at me to get the hell out of there and go away and leave her alone.
A year passed, and the building around Edith Macefield's house got bigger and bigger.
And Barry kept dropping off business cards, telling her to call if she needed anything. And then one day, she finally did.
Could I give her a ride to go get her hair done? You know, we got her in the car and started driving over there, and we were kind of talking about how, you know, Ballard was changing.
And sort of surprisingly, Edith Macefield wasn't angry about the way Ballard was changing. She wasn't even angry about the mall they were building more or less on top of her house.
She said, because it always changes. That's just the way it goes. She had no reason to move. She didn't have any family. So getting the money so that she could leave it for her family didn't exist.
Mrs. Masefield didn't have any living family to leave any money to. And by the same token, she didn't have any family to help take care of her in her old age.
Pretty soon, Barry started taking her to all of her appointments. Then he got concerned that Mrs. Masefield, who was getting more frail by the day, was going to burn herself on her stove. So
I just started swinging by there after work and making her dinner.
Pretty soon, Barry was making her lunch and breakfast as well.
One day I woke up and I'm making her three meals a day.
Barry took care of Mrs. Masefield for nearly a year and a half, visiting with her on weekends and after work. Sometimes she'd call in the middle of the night and tell him she'd had an accident and she needed him.
You know, she had very few wishes. One, she wanted to die in her house, you know, live out her last days in her house. And I was able to help fulfill those wishes.
Edith Masefield died in her house on June 15th, 2008. She was 86 years old. She left her house to Barry Martin, the construction superintendent who became her friend while simultaneously sandwiching her house between a Trader Joe's and an LA Fitness. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Katie Mingle with Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, and me, Roman Mars. We are a project of KALW and distributed by PRX. More at 99pi.org.
You ever think, I'd love to write a novel, I just don't have the time? Well, there's always November. When Word of Mouth returns, the founder of National Novel Writing Month shares hints on how you can write 50,000 words in just 30 days or less. That's after the news, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. November is a busy month between Thanksgiving, getting ready for the holidays, and here in the Northeast, dealing with the lack of sunlight. It is easy to feel overwhelmed. So it may come as a bit of a surprise that our next guest thinks November is a great month to finally write that novel you've been talking about. He calls it NaNoWriMo, or National Novel Writing Month. And every November, writers from around the world take the challenge, write 50,000 words in just 30 days. Chris Beatty is a teacher, he's a speaker, a writer, and founder of NaNoWriMo. He has an updated edition of the book he wrote in 2004 to help writers finally take the plunge. It is called No Plot, No Problem. Chris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So how did NaNoWriMo come to be?
So it began back in the distant days of 1999. I was 26 years old, kind of confused about what I was doing with my life. And I think I was just kind of hungry for some ridiculous challenge. And I had always loved books and reading and revered authors. And I just thought, what if I got together a group of friends and we all wrote novels? And that seemed exciting and then terrifying. And then I thought, what if we did it in a month, which would then give us excuses to write bad novels or quit, which also seemed appealing. So that was the auspicious beginning of National Novel Writing Month, is a group of friends here in California all setting sail towards this horizon of a beautifully mediocre first draft of a novel.
Okay, so that's the point, huh? The beautiful mediocre. You just got to get it out of you?
I think so. Well, so one of the things I've discovered over now, good grief, 16 years of doing this, is that whether you give yourself 30 days to write your first draft or you give yourself 3 years to write your first draft, it will be this wonderful mix of kind of perfect, unexpected plot twists and great developments, really interesting characters, but also have just a lot of things wrong with it. And this is true whether you're a professional writer and you've done this a million times, or whether this is your first one. So in my experience, you know, human beings are really wonderful procrastinators, and we will, you know, if we have too much time to do something, sometimes it just never gets done. So the thing that I discovered is if you give yourself this really ridiculously short amount of time to do it, you do get it done. And in the process, I think the writing is actually just about as good as it would be if you gave yourself more time.
So why 50,000 words?
50,000 words was a scientifically calculated number, which I performed by grabbing the absolute shortest novel on my bookshelf in 1999, counting the words and saying, okay, let's go with this
You actually counted them?
Yeah, it's, you know, there needs to be some rigor in this whole thing. It's not just a lot of drinking coffee and diving into a book, please.
So 15 years later, your pet project is all grown up. How many novels have you written and how many have been published?
So I have written I have written 15 first drafts of novels, and I am deep in revisions on three of those. I am a total perfectionist, actually, when it comes to writing, which makes it strange that I have founded National Novel Writing Month. But I really obsess over quality once I get to the second and third and fourth draft stages. So I'm hoping that one of these will be released from my iron claw of perfectionism out into the world at some point soon.
Well, so bravo. Give us some tips for cranking out 50,000 words during such a busy month. I mean, who has long stretches of time to write during November?
Right. Well, the first tip is to know that you will not ever feel ready to write a novel. You know, we are all too busy to do this, really. And you may not have time, but you can always make time. So I would say know that even if you have a really busy work schedule, that you have a family that you need to take care of, that you can do this. You know, for a lot of people, the amount of time it takes is anywhere between about an hour and a half to 2 hours per day of writing. And for a month, you can find those pockets of time. It may mean that you get up a little earlier, you go to bed a little later, maybe you secretly novel at work while your boss isn't looking, whatever it takes to get some time. But another tip that I would give people, especially people who say, I'd like to do this, I love books, I love reading novels, I don't have any ideas for my own, is to make a very simple list, which is a list of things you love to read in books. And that could be, you know, types of books. Maybe you love mysteries. Maybe you love books set in workplaces. Maybe you love cliffhanger chapter endings or first-person narration or books that have pets in them. Make that list, and then when you look at that list, that is also the list of things that you would do well to write about in your novel, because the things that resonate with us as readers are things that we wield well as writers. So, in fact, there's a ton of inspirations that are already flowing through our lives. It's just a matter of recognizing that.
And you tell the story of one guy, Tim. He cranks out 38,000 words in just 3 days and hit the 50,000 with 15 minutes to spare.
It's true. Yeah, it's never too late to start is what I'll say. There's a really long and established history of come-from-behind victories in National Novel Writing Month. So the other thing I would say is, you know, the official goal is 50,000 words, but every year we have people writing, you know, setting out to write 10,000 words in a month or 20,000 words. You know, it's really anything that sort of helps you make a commitment to make time for creativity is really a win. So if ultimately this month you don't get time to do the full 50,000, do the first half in the second half of November, and then do the second half of your book in the first half of December. You can do it. It's there for you.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to ask, you know, why such a tight deadline?
Well, the tight deadline, I think, comes in because the human imagination really, if you give it too much time, will just sit on the couch eating Doritos. That's really what it wants to do. It loves Cool Ranch Doritos, by the way. So have some around in November. But, you know, the tight deadline, I think, forces us to make this something that we orient our lives around. You know, all of these projects, art, music, writing, they always tend to fall to the bottom of our to-do list because we're not getting paid to do them. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. But I think when you have this crazy, impossible deadline, it's somehow easier to hit than a merely difficult deadline because you really take it seriously. You know every day you need to write 1,667 words or you will fall into that desperate, sad hole of word count debt, and nobody wants to be in that position. So you actually get it done.
Well, I really appreciate that you have some ideas for cheating or padding on the word count. What are some of those?
Right. Well, so this is, you know, momentum is key in National Novel Writing Month. And there are times when you're writing late at night, you've just kind of, you're exhausted, but you do want to get some word count in. So, you know, one of the many established things at that point is you can give your character a kind of a middle and last name that gets repeated. You could have, you know, a Virginia could become Virginia May Marie, which that just netted you a few more words. You can give some characters maybe a stutter so that they repeat the things that they're saying. That's some words. And, of course, the biggest one of all is the dream sequence, which is really an infinite word mine that you can go on. But, you know, these are really just kind of desperate measures should you find yourself in desperate times. Most people actually do find that once they start writing, there's plenty of story there. And 50,000 words is a pretty short novel. I mean, this is sort of a...
Gatsby, right?
It's an Of Mice and Men. The end actually comes very surprisingly quickly. It doesn't feel like that when you're in the middle of the month and kind of want to die, but it does come, and you're always so excited to get there.
Well, before we get to the filling, your book is called No Plot, No Problem, but you do actually advise people to have a bit of a plot. So when do you advise having that part of the process nailed down, before you even start?
Well, it really depends on your personality. And in my experience, people, there are planners out there, and they just love that process of making these character sketches and doing story outlines where they have all of the scenes kind of laid out, and they have the conflicts and the turning points, and they even know how the book's going to end. And for those people, having that outline actually makes the writing process feel more spontaneous and organic. They can kind of loosen up a little bit and take some risks on the page because they feel comfortable knowing where the story is going. If that is you, plan to your heart's content. Start a year before National Novel Writing Month. You know, really bring everything you need, collages, soundtracks. But there are also people out there that just love the thrill of winging it. And my first National Novel Writing Month manuscript, I wrote without a plot, a character, a setting. I just kind of started writing, and the book was not a great book. I think the technical industry term for the book I wrote was a bad book, but it had potential. It was really fun, and I learned a lot from it. So I would say if the idea of improvising a novel appeals to you, do it. And in fact, so many great works of art have been made exactly that way. I'm reading this book by the president of Pixar, and it sounds like they do a little bit of planning beforehand, but then a lot of their movies, which we think of as pretty great stories, are just discovered along the way, and a lot of things change and new decisions are made, and that's part of what makes those movies feel so fresh and spontaneous.
Mm-hmm. So we don't have to do this in November, correct?
Any month could be National Novel Writing Month. The nice thing about November is you get to sign up on the National Novel Writing Month website, and you get all these pep talks from great authors. We have authors like Nick Hornby and Sue Grafton and Amy Bender and Dave Eggers, and they send out emails to our participants basically with these sort of can-do pats on the butt, and that is nice. And then you also have access to the National Novel Writing Month forums where you can post questions. So if you are writing a murder mystery set in Iceland, you can connect with Icelandic participants and say, hey, how do people kill each other in Iceland? Which is a great and complex question. So
that is so great.
It's nice. And then there's also something I think about the idea of winning. So every year we have tens of thousands of winners. I mean, National Novel Writing Month is a pretty weird writing contest. So this year we'll probably have close to 40,000 winners. And there's something nice about having a finish line that you know tens of thousands of people are also heading to. I think in the same way that running a marathon by yourself is much more difficult than running a marathon when you're part of a crowd. So there's just something about this pool of energy that is created when a lot of people are tackling the same endeavor.
Has any famous novels gotten their start during NaNoWriMo?
There have. An ever-increasing number of people have written either the first draft in November or written the first 50,000 words and then completed it as, you know, a couple months later and then started revising it. And I do want to stress that this is a first draft you were writing in November. I wish you could start with like a third draft, but unfortunately you start with a first draft. These people have gone on to revise it. And at this point we've had hundreds of traditionally published manuscripts, tens of thousands of self-published, and I think up to 10 New York Times bestsellers, including a book called Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen that was made into a big Hollywood movie.
I remember.
The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern was a big hit last year. Wool by Hugh Howey. Cinder, which is a young adult series. Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell. We've had a bunch of books that have gone on to really become beloved stories that millions of people have read.
Well, Chris, have you done your 1,667 words yet today?
I'm so far behind. I can't even tell you. Virginia, I need you to just email me a block of 1,667 words.
I have a dream sequence I've been working on.
Please, I need it.
Thank you so much for spending so much time with us.
It's great to be here.
Chris Beatty, founder of NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month. He's also author of the revised edition of No Plot, No Problem. And we do have links to the NaNoWriMo website and the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Before the age of television, radio dramas were a primary source of family entertainment. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll tune into how podcasts are breathing new life into the radio drama. That's after the break. Stay with us.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The golden age of radio is long gone. Its short reign as go-to entertainment was taken over by television in the 1950s, and now many people don't even own a radio. Among the casualties, the humble radio drama.
From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Dramas were once must-hear radio, with families clustered around a giant piece of furniture that housed the radio to listen to the latest serialized programs. In 1938, Orson Welles' broadcast of The War of the Worlds convinced many listeners that Martians were actually invading the Earth. Now that podcasts are gaining a big following, the contemporary radio drama is developing a bit of a cult following, thanks to the seemingly unlimited distribution capabilities of the Internet. Caitlin Benedict is radio drama columnist for Exeunt magazine and a podcast producer. She's based in London, where the radio drama still has a foothold on traditional airwaves. Caitlin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go through some of the dramas that you talk about in your articles. Homefront, now in its second season on BBC Radio 4, available on iTunes as a podcast. What is this series about?
Homefront is a really interesting project, actually, because it follows in a 100 years to the day kind of time lapse formation, the unfolding of the First World War from the perspective of people who are living in the United Kingdom and not themselves going off to fight. I think it's a really interesting project, even more than it is great as a sort of 15-minute drama, because it is going to take 4.5 years, and it's the largest single radio drama commissioned by the BBC.
So 4.5 years, so it's going to be sort of a real-time broadcast of the First World War, the Great War, as you call it in Britain?
Yeah, that's right. That's the intention, and different series will focus on different parts of the United Kingdom. The first series, and in fact the second series as well, mostly take place in Folkestone, which is where the kind of Dig for Victory efforts really started.
Well, let's hear just a little clip from Homefront, now in its second season on BBC Radio 4.
Did you hear that, Hillary, about Alan William George Campbell? A son born on October the 27th, 1930, not a year old, and his father is dead. And this young man, Lieutenant Pringle, was 19 years of age.
You must stop this, son.
No, people need to hear it. They need to realize.
They do realize.
Not enough. Hillary.
Look, why don't we go inside the town hall and get you some tea? It's quite cold and you aren't wearing a coat.
I don't see the point in wearing a coat.
A coat would keep you warm.
Can you imagine how cold Freddy was?
Please, sir.
Imagine it, Hillary.
You cannot stay here reading from the paper. It isn't right.
Have you got a cigarette?
A cigarette?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I don't smoke.
Is that because you're a vegetarian?
No. No.
Really fancy smoke. Why don't we go on the hunt for cigarettes, you and I?
One of the dramas that you did review that is available online at the moment, it's actually produced in the U.S. It's called Welcome to Night Vale. Tell us about this one.
Welcome to Night Vale is kind of an extraordinary success story, I think. And I think you mentioned War of the Worlds earlier, and I think it's a total spiritual successor to War of the Worlds in a way. There's that idea that it could all really be happening in the way that it's presented. Welcome to Night Vale's conceit, for those who haven't heard it, is that it is a local radio station, a community radio station, and it's as if you're just picking up the radio station's broadcast for that week. But the town that they're broadcasting to and speaking about in the broadcast is a pretty unusual place. It's got very, very strong shades of Lovecraft, although I know they hate that comparison. And Edgar Allan Poe and sort of X-Files-y kind of vibe as well. It's a really interesting concoction of urban fantasy and horror and sci-fi.
Let's listen to just a clip from Welcome to Night Vale. This is from creators Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink.
A new man came into town today. Who is he? What does he want from us? Why his perfect and beautiful haircut? Why his perfect and beautiful coat? He says he is a scientist. Well, we have all been scientists at one point or another in our lives. But why now? Why here? And just what does he plan to do with all those breakers and humming electrical instruments in that lab he's renting, the one next to Big Rico's Pizza? No one does a slice like Big Rico. No one.
Now, Caitlin, that we're officially into November, is it safe to pick out a few highlights from the Christmas special radio schedule?
Absolutely. I mean, the one that I'm the most excited about is one of my absolute favorite books that's being adapted into a radio drama that is going to be the 45-minute slot over a week on Radio 4 and ending on Christmas Eve with an hour-long conclusion, and that is Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman.
Oh, yes. Two of our favorites.
I think I've owned three copies of Good Omens, and they've all fallen apart from overuse. Dirk Maggs, who is directing Good Omens, also did Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the reproduction of Hitchhiker's Guide, and Neverwhere for Radio 4 last year, which was extremely successful and starred Benedict Cumberbatch and therefore was going to get a lot of attention.
Oh, so, right.
He's definitely got his corner of the world as the man who makes the greatest nerdy radio drama on the highest budgets.
When I think of Kenneth Branagh, Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, a lot of actors are praised for their ability to be able to speak with just a look. What kind of acting ability does it take to make a great radio drama actor, male or female?
The great requirement of the radio drama actor is really to be able to read and act at the same time. And that, you know, is quite an undertaking, actually. The level of rehearsal you get as a radio drama actor is not in any way comparable to television or, you know, obviously to theatre, where you have a period of weeks to rehearse. Radio drama actors will get maybe two or three goes through before the microphone gets turned on. So that's quite major. That takes a lot of very, very good reading. It takes a lot of quick intellectualization of what they are doing, and it takes an underlying technical capacity to be able to speak in a way that is very, very different to theatre acting and to television acting to an extent as well, because the idea of projecting in the way that you would in theatre is not what you're after when it comes to radio drama, because, you know, an actor who pitches to an audience in the same way is going to sound absolutely ridiculous over a close microphone. So having that sort of sensitivity to the microphones around you without losing your head, without losing all of your integrity as a performer, you know, it takes a lot of technical skill.
Well, thank you for the previews, Caitlin, and thank you for the translation from English, of course.
You're very welcome.
Caitlin Benedict, radio drama columnist for Exeunt magazine and a podcast producer. We do have a list of the radio dramas that she outlined with a link to where you can listen online. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we spoke with the actor and author Asif Manvi about his new book, No Land's Man, and what it's like being The Daily Show's Muslim / senior Middle Eastern / foreign-looking correspondent.
As the years went by, I realized, like, oh, I was able to speak into the zeitgeist in some way, and it was really affecting American Muslims, more than it was affecting policy or lawmakers or the media. It was affecting American Muslims, and they were excited about it. And that sort of, in a weird way, sort of made me feel kind of Muslimy, you know, and it was very uncomfortable for a while.
If you missed that conversation or anything else on the show, you can hear it in its entirety by subscribing to the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search for Word of Mouth on iTunes or find the link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, and catch all of the interesting conversations and stories that we play. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.